Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show on Myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Panel, joining you from India. And I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. This is Cure Panel's 57th episode, and on our myeloma broadcast today, we are discussing using clinical trial data to determine treatment options. My co-host for the show today is myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. On the panel are Cure panelists Jack Aiello, Cynthia Schmulewski, and Lizzie Smith. We have a very eminent expert with us today, Dr. Philip McCarthy. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Thank you for the invitation.
Before I hand over to Gary to introduce the expert and begin with the show, I would like to mention to the audience that if you have a question for Dr. McCarthy, please press 1 on your keypad and we can bring you on air to ask your question. Gary will now introduce us to our expert. Gary, you're live on air.
Hi, Priya. Thank you so much. And Dr. McCarthy, thank you as well for giving us your time during this this educational series that we have for multiple myeloma patients.
Hello?
Gary, you there?
I think we lost him.
Gary, hello, Gary, can you hear me? By the time, I think we have just lost Gary for a minute or so. By the time he calls back, I'd like to introduce our expert to our audience today. Dr. McCarthy is a director of the Blood and Marrow Transplant Program at Roseville Park Cancer Institute and a professor of oncology. Dr. McCarthy has been a BMT physician and hematologist and oncologist since finishing fellowship training in 1989. He has been the BMT director at the RPCI since 1997. Dr. McCarthy is a member of the ASH and ASCO, and his research interests are devoted to developing new auto and allo treatments for hematological disorders, including myeloma, that will lead to improved patient outcomes and decreased toxicity. It's a great honor to have you here, Dr. McCarthy. Gary, if you're on air, please begin with the discussion.
Okay. Priya, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you loud and clear now.
Okay, well, fantastic. Sorry about that. Somehow I got cut off, and so thank you so much, Priya, for taking over for me. I do appreciate that. And Dr. McCarthy, thank you again for the time that you're spending with us on this program. I know that you are very much involved with a lot of clinical trials, as well as you have your own database that you work with in order to develop your treatment protocols for your patients. And I also know that, you know, your organization, much like Memorial Sloan Kettering and the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, have been a source of talent, and one of those graduates is Dr. Asher Chanin Khan in Mayo, Jacksonville, who worked with you for a number of years and now, you know, runs their Mayo Southern Jacksonville operation. What I'd like to ask you, Doctor, is how do you integrate the data from clinical trials with your own clinical data to determine the best treatment options for your patients?
Sure. Well, that's a broad question, and I'd be happy to answer it. And we may break it up because I don't want to talk for too long. We look at a variety of options because the first thing we do is we consider what are the most reasonable clinical trials to open for our patients. And we'll focus, of course, on multiple myeloma today. So I work very closely with our multiple myeloma doctor. We have a new recruit from University of Iowa, Sarah Holstein, who has a lot of interesting trials. They're all preclinical, looking at new drug development for the treatment of myeloma. And as you know, a lot of new drugs are first tried out in patients who have relapsed myeloma. So I guess we sort of, that's the first sort of decision tree. Is the patient newly diagnosed, or is the patient a patient who has already received therapy for multiple myeloma and then now is receiving some form of what we would call salvage therapy to generate a good response after the disease has progressed after initial treatment? So we factor a lot of things in when we make decisions regarding clinical trials. We also have mandates from the National Cancer Institute. The NCI doesn't want us to have too many trials open at once, and we don't accrue enough patients, because the most important thing is to get a study done and then move on to the next study, because if you don't complete a trial in a timely manner, you may be asking a question that is outdated. So we have a lot of these types of issues that get factored into how we make decisions about what trials we should open and also what trials we should be developing internally so that it allows us to ask some new questions. So as you know, there's different types of trials. There's phase one, which look at the toxicity of a new treatment, phase two, which is looking at efficacy, phase three, which is comparing your new drug or new set of drugs versus whatever is the gold standard. And those are the three types of trials that we will be thinking about when we're trying to develop the best approach for how we want to treat a myeloma patient. Sometimes we may adopt a standard of care approach because the patient, say, has comorbidities or has other types of issues going on that won't allow them to go on a clinical trial. But our first thought, as always, when we are trying to treat a patient is, are they eligible for a trial? And if they are so eligible, we will offer the patient that trial as a first option. But again, depending if they're newly diagnosed or are receiving treatment for salvage.
You have, this is something that just kind of came to mind, you have several hundred patients a year, don't you?
We transplant about 150 transplants a year. So those are transplants. We see several hundreds of patients of all different types of diagnoses.
Right.
For myeloma, we see about, I think, new diagnoses, we see about 60 to 70, I believe. But I'd have to talk to Dr. Holstein about that.
Okay. And on clinical trials, what percentage of people would be on clinical trials?
We do, as the Institute as a whole, we get about 10% of only of our patients on clinical trials, which, of course, is disappointing. Some of our sections do better than others. On our patients, or the BMT patients, we put about 15% on clinical trials. And now with our myeloma patients, we were a little bit low, but we're now also around 10% on trials. And obviously, we need to do better. Some of that is due to the fact that some patients don't like to go on trials. They feel they don't like to be, especially if it's a randomization. We're trying to get people to understand that if we knew what we were doing, we wouldn't be doing the trial. In other words, until we cure everybody, we always are going to be wanting to do a clinical trial that will make everybody get better. So I think a lot of people, they don't like that. So the Europeans in the past have been much better at enrolling patients on clinical trials, primarily because the way their healthcare system is set up, a lot of patients didn't have access to new drugs unless they enrolled on a trial. Here in the U.S., it's a little different. But what people don't understand is a lot of these new drugs came about because somebody participated in a trial 5, 6, 7 years ago, which then allowed this drug to come into the clinic.
Okay. So one of the questions I had was that you use not only clinical trial data, which would be 10% of a couple hundred patients, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like 20 patients, and versus the total number of patients that you have, which is like 200 or so. As a result, you have far more data available with your patients versus with clinical trials. And so, you know, those two together is my guess that that's the data that you use. Is that correct?
It, well, yes, it depends what we're using it for. So, for example, and in fact, you've been very persistent in wanting us to get our stuff out there, and I've had to push my epidemiologist because she's very guarded, because the one thing about data is that there's data and there's data. So, for example, I'll give you, and we're going to be posting this on our website, and you'll be able to access this very soon. From 2007 to 2013, we've done four myeloma, 148 transplants. 138 were first autos, and the rest were second autos. And of those, 112 received full-dose melphalan, and then 18 were lower-dose melphalan, and those 18 include a fair number of amyloid patients, which is a little bit more complicated than multiple myeloma alone. And so what we then do is we then see what is our day 100 mortality, morbidity, what is our 1 year. And we have done very well. Our 1 year overall survival is 94%. And unfortunately, the patients who have not done well have been those who have had recurrence of their disease before the 1 year. So what we then have done is we've actually I'll give you an example of where we use our data. We have been looking at what we call flow cytometry. Flow cytometry is a way of measuring markers on the cell surface of both normal and abnormal cells to tell us different cell populations either in the blood or the bone marrow. Since myeloma is primarily a bone marrow disease, we do flow cytometry to look for helping us determine if the marrow contains multiple myeloma, and then we often will do minimal residual disease testing, first pioneered in particular by the Spanish, but we have an excellent flow cytometrist here, Paul Wallace, who looks for minimal residual disease. And Paul is doing the MRD testing for the BMT-CTN trial, which just closed in November. It's a study looking at single transplant versus tandem versus single followed by consolidation. And at landmarks along the way, Paul's laboratory has been measuring the presence or absence of malignant plasma cells, and then telling us, and then we're going to look to see whether or not this tells us how well patients will do in the long term. And that study is still ongoing. But another thing we did, which we just talked about at the last ASH meeting, the American Society of Hematology, is we're starting to look at subsets of T cells within the peripheral blood to tell us whether or not patients will do well or poorly. And the Mayo Clinic has previously reported that if you look at the absolute lymphocyte recovery at day 15, and if it's above a certain level, 500 cells per microliter, those patients do better in the long run. And we never have really been able to understand why that is. But what we were able to show is that that patients who have certain T-cell and natural killer cell and B-cell populations in the peripheral blood pre-transplant at day 30 and at day 100, those patients may do better if they have certain different types of populations. Now what we're trying to figure out, okay, we've made this observation, how can we get everybody to have this type of immune signature, and does that correlate long-term with overall survival? We have some data that says it does. Now we have to figure out how we can get all patients to have this good overall survival.
Well, I got to say that given what you just said, which was that you, I think it was 94% for the first year survival.
Correct.
Well, you know, given the fact that the SEER data for 1 year survival for all myeloma patients is just 75 to 80%, I'd say your data is downright remarkable. So.
Yeah.
why wouldn't want to put that out there online? I have no clue. People be flocking to you.
No. Well, you have this data and there's data. Here's why. Because the SEER data is all comers. So those are people in renal failure, people who've got cardiac disease. And we do, you know, patients who undergo, who are transplant eligible, are fit, because patients who are transplant ineligible, if we were to do a stem cell transplant on them, the high-dose melphalan could be too toxic and they could die of complications. So we don't transplant everybody we see. Why? Because I don't want to cause unnecessary harm. So no, I appreciate the compliment, but we do have a selected population. And in fact, as you may know, for some studies require transplant-eligible patients to pass certain criteria. They have to have a fit heart, fit kidney function, not always, and fit lung function, because if they have too many what we call comorbidities, they won't be able to withstand the high-dose melphalan, and they would have serious complications. So I appreciate the compliment.
What percentage then of patients, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, go ahead.
What percentage of patients then are eliminated because of those types of issues?
Sure. The majority of patients who we see are able to get a stem cell transplant. We used to have an upper age limit, and then first the upper age limit was 65, then it was 70, and now we got rid of it. We don't do too many 80-year-olds. We do patients in their 70s, though. And they have to be in reasonable shape. So a lot of times I may not even see somebody, because if they are, say if they have bad lung disease or they have other comorbidities, terrible cardiac disease, where they're in congestive heart failure all the time, they aren't going to be a good candidate, because we will probably cause them more harm than good because the stress of the transplant is too much. But the majority of patients, I'm just guessing if I told you, probably about 75 to 85, 90% of patients we would at least consider. And if they have serious comorbidities, we give them a dose reduction in their melphalan. So, for example, we have patients in renal failure who will get a stem cell transplant. That's not a contraindication. But if you have somebody who has horrible lung or heart disease, they may not be able to withstand that type of treatment.
Okay. What treatment protocols have you developed utilizing this data, your own data plus clinical trial data?
Most of what we do rely on the literature. So I will give a shout out or kudos to Dr. Barlogi and Dr. McElwain, who first developed and pioneered the use of high-dose melphalan. Dr. McElwain in Britain, Great Britain, where he dose escalated melphalan, and then found, of course, it got too toxic at very high levels because it was too toxic to the marrow. But Dr. Barlogi was the first one who showed that with a bone marrow rescue, you could get the patient through high-dose melphalan and rescue them from the toxic effects on the marrow. And essentially, he did the first autologous stem cell transplant using bone marrow. And I think it's very important to acknowledge his contributions, because he pushed the field. So we use that type of information to then allow for the development of the use of peripheral blood. And both investigators in the U.S. and the United States then found that mobilized peripheral blood, first with chemotherapy mobilization and now with GCSF and this new drug plerixafor, you can mobilize stem cells and use those for the rescue from high-dose melphalan. So we continue to use MEL-200, 200 milligrams per meter squared, as our standard, both in clinical trials and in our patients who receive standard of care. We are interested in developing a novel combination, but you need to have a lot of patients. So we've elected not to develop, say, a new high-dose chemotherapy regimen and participate in large clinical trials that answer those types of questions, such as the BMCTN or the CLGB studies. We also will, for example, with induction regimens, we rely heavily on other trials. And to be quite frank, everybody talks about using triple drug induction regimens for transplant-eligible patients, usually lenalidomide in combination with bortezomib and steroids, Decatron, or using cyclophosphamide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone. In that study, there's the phase 2 evolution trial, which Shashi Kumar was the first author on, which showed that they were very similar results. However, we've not had a true phase 3. And I'm not sure if we will have a phase three because the induction regimens have gotten so good that it's been hard to pick between those two regimens as to which one is better. Now, the ECOG, the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, is doing a CRD versus VRD, which is, or RVD. It's a carfilzomib, lenalidomide dex, versus bortezomib, lenalidomide dex. And that's probably going to inform us as to which regimen may be better for, that's for standard risk myeloma patients. The Southwest Oncology Group is going to be is now doing a trial looking at RVD, lenalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone, as the control group, and then they're going to add elotuzumab, the anti-CS1 antibody, and this is for high-risk myeloma patients. And then we're going to participate in a BMT-CTN trial, which is allogeneic transplant for very high-risk myeloma patients, say if they have deletion 17 or have a gene expression profile that's high-risk. Those patients would be offered, potentially, if they were young and otherwise fit, an allogeneic trial, if it's a phase two trial, to see if we can potentially cure myeloma. So a lot of what we do, we try and decide what fits at our center for development of trials, and a lot of what we're doing now is that flow cytometry data I talked about earlier. And then we want to see, can we participate in larger trials? Because sometimes the only way you can answer questions is to do a very large trial, have hundreds of patients on it, and most centers don't have hundreds of patients. And so you need to cooperate with other centers to be able to ask important questions.
Okay. One of the things that I've found, you know, in talking to a lot of doctors, you know, and very good, remarkable institutions, is that their data isn't easily accessible. It's not, you know, it's not easy to mine. They seem like they have to just use brute force in order to come up with you know, simple data on does this particular protocol have a better life expectancy than this other one, or better you know, progression-free survival. Do you have a system that you're able to mine, or is yours equally as outmoded?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say they're outmoded, but here's the deal. Because, number one, you have to look, let's look at demographics. If you're looking at one study versus another, what's the age of the patient? So you will look at often the median. The median is half the patients are above this age, and half the patients are below. So, for example, in our patients who've undergone stem cell transplant, the median age is 60, and our range is 28 to 73. We have done a patient who has been 28 years of age, and our oldest so far is 73, although we just did somebody who's 76, but he's not yet in our database. And then you have to see, okay, what is their stage? How many of them by ISS, the International Scoring System, using beta-2 microglobulin albumin, are they? How many are stage 1? How many are stage 2? How many are stage 3? And then using DuraSalmon, that's another staging system, same thing. How many are 1, 2, or 3? And then what was the time from when they were diagnosed to when they initiated therapy? And when they initiated therapy, what is the time from initiation of therapy to the time of transplant? Because somebody who's diagnosed early, gets induction, goes straight into transplant is very different than somebody who's diagnosed, gets regular chemotherapy, say gets put on some maintenance, doesn't go to transplant, and then relapses and then gets their stem cell transplant. So I think that type of granularity is why people get very skittish about trying to compare stuff, because sometimes you're comparing apples and oranges. You know what I'm saying? And that's why people, it's not that they're deliberately trying to keep data away from you. It's just what we want to make sure that it's truly a valid comparison. Do you want another example? I can give you one more example.
Sure.
The French IFM 0502 study, which is a lenalidomide maintenance study, which is lenalidomide maintenance versus placebo after single or tandem transplant, That's been compared a lot to CLGB-100-104, which is also a lenalidomide maintenance study. And we have had numerous discussions about the differences between those two studies, even though they look on the face of it that they are, they're both transplant studies and maintenance studies. So everybody says, oh, you should be able to compare them. Well, they're really different because both studies have showed a progression-free benefit, progression-free survival benefit for lenalidomide maintenance. But the French study has not shown an overall survival benefit. Indeed, they feel that the overall survival after progression on the lenalidomide arm is inferior. We don't see that in CLGB-100-104. Now, here are two studies, very similar patient populations initially, but their induction regimens were vincristine, Adriamycin, dexamethasone, VAD, in half their patient, and the other half got bortezomib dex. And on 100-104, 74% of patients got either a thalidomide or a lenalidomide-based induction regimen, totally different. And then one quarter of their patients got DCEP, consolidation pretransplant. 20% of their patients got two transplants. All of our patients only got one. They had a two-month lenalidomide consolidation before randomization to len versus no len. And then they didn't allow a crossover. We allowed a crossover once the primary endpoint was met, and we allowed the placebo patients who hadn't progressed to receive lenalidomide. So we have all these differences, which really we have spent months discussing this. And people still are pro and con lenalidomide maintenance just because the studies are different.
I see. Okay. I've got a few more questions, but I'm going to hold off on those because we've just, you've done an excellent job in explaining, the ones that I've already talked about. However, we have a number of questions from the panel, and I'd like to get to those at this point. And later on, I might, if I've got time, I'll ask some of those questions that I've yet to cover. Jack, are you online?
I'm online. Can you hear me?
You bet I can. Your question?
Hi, Dr. McCarthy. I hope spring has sprung in Buffalo.
It has.
Good.
Finally.
I've read that 25% of phase 3 trials close early due to lack of accruals. I wonder if the figure is accurate for myeloma trials. If a trial does close early, does that mean the data isn't used at all because of insufficient numbers or it's just questioned? And I guess lastly, as you have patient advocates on the phone here, is there anything you can recommend that we can do to increase accruals?
Sure. You raise a really good point. That's 25% of all trials. And a lot depends. If you design, you have to have a really good statistician help you design a trial. And we had an awesome one for CLGB-100-104, and I'd like to give a shout-out to Koros Ozar, who's at Duke, and he really designed a great study. But it was a large study. We accrued over 400 patients on this study. So when we first opened this trial, and I'll bring in, this is a good lesson, and when you don't want to have two large national trials open at the same time, because there is the BMT-CTN-0102 trial, which is two transplants versus tandem autos versus an auto followed by an allo. And that study was open at the same time, so the 100-104 accrual wasn't very good. And 100-104 came within about 6 to 12 months of closing if we did not increase accrual. And what happened was 0102 closed, 100-104 accrual picked up, and we were able to actually finish the study and answer a very important question about maintenance. So a lot depends on the size of the trial, because if the trial is very large, you need to accrue patients quickly. You don't want to have it drag out for too long a period of time, because the standard of care changes from when this trial was first designed and then opened to, say, 3 or 4 or 5 years in. So you can't have a trial that's lagging and stays open too long, because the accrual will start to falter, and then people may be doing different types of treatment. So it's a really good point that phase 3 trials in particular are a, a good thing to consider when a patient is being offered a potential clinical trial.
And something we as patient advocates can do to maybe help increase the accruals?
Yeah, I think it's important to encourage patients to consider clinical trials, because if we don't, but for the goodness of people's hearts, if they enroll on trials, because they're not just because they're being altruistic, they want to get good treatment, and these trials are designed to give good treatment to the patients. So, for example, there's the there's the French-American study. It's an IFM-DFCI. DFCI is Dana-Farber. IFM is the International Francophone Myeloma Group. It's the International Myeloma Working Group of France. And the French arm has closed, but the American arm continues open, and that is a transplant now versus transplant later. And that's a lenalidomide bortezomib dex induction. And then patients either get three cycles, I believe, stem cells are collected and they go on to transplant, or they continue the RVD chemo after stem cell collection. And then all patients go on lenalidomide until progression. And that study, it's a little different because it's a transplant early versus transplant late. But since most patients with myeloma get transplanted, their disease will come back. The question is whether or not it's important to have that transplant up front or to delay it to first progression, because at least retrospective data has said there's no difference. Now, there are two other studies that have asked us in Italy, both of which have closed, and one of them is a melphalan-prednisone lenalidomide induction. Lenalidomide dexamethasone induction followed by a randomization to melphalan-prednisone lenalidomide versus transplant. And that study's been closed, and they're actually submitted it for publication. And that has asked a very important question about transplant now versus delayed transplant. So those are the types of things that we think are important. There are some other clinical trials in development for myeloma. For example, the BMT-CTN is going to be opening a vaccine trial. That's very exciting. David Avigan from Beth Israel in Boston is the principal investigator, and that's going to involve patients being enrolled early so some of their cells can be taken out and a vaccine developed with their own myeloma cells. And then there's a randomization at the end to either getting the vaccine with lenalidomide or just getting lenalidomide following a stem cell transplant. And that's a really important trial, which I think hopefully will be exciting for patients. So there are a lot of these trials which unfortunately take years sometimes to get into development. I know David's been working on this for a couple of years, and hopefully it'll be open by the end of this year. The CLGB100-104 study, we sent the first concept in 2001. We didn't open the trial until 2005. That was after 11 protocol revisions. And we didn't close until 2009, and it wasn't unblinded until 2010. So that was a long time to have a study from first concept to actual finishing accrual. So I think it's important for patient advocates and patients to strongly consider clinical trials, because you get the best therapy, you are very closely monitored, you are then comparing it to a therapy that might be better or might not be better. My feeling is they're either going to be the same or the new therapy may be better, but we don't know that. And we've been surprised sometimes. A good example is transplant for breast cancer, where everybody thought everybody should get an autologous stem cell transplant for high-risk breast cancer. Well, the studies were done and found out that they were equivalent to chemotherapy, so we don't do stem cell transplants for breast cancer anymore. And that was because patients were willing to enroll on clinical trials.
Thank you very much.
Cindy, are you online?
I am.
Hello,
Dr. McCarthy.
Hi. Yeah.
How you doing tonight?
I'm great. It's a beautiful day in Buffalo. The sun is shining.
Oh, that's great, because here in New Jersey, it's windy. I can't wait for spring to show up.
Oh, it's supposed to be here soon.
I hope so. So my question is, I'm hearing a lot about genomics and, you know, in this era where everyone is trying to get their genes sequenced, I was just wondering, are there any clinical trials now being designed based on a myeloma patient's genomics to maybe target a certain pathway for a certain subgroup of patients? Are we getting into that type of thinking yet, or are we lagging a little bit behind, or what's happening there?
We're getting there, but we at least now have at least the beginnings of it based on cytogenetics. So as you may know, the myeloma cells sometimes have chromosome shuffling that occurs that gives different types of chromosome deletions, translocations where a piece of one chromosome is deleted, two chromosomes may exchange information, and the one chromosome may gain some information, and this has allowed us to risk stratify. So we know, for example, in the old days, deletion 13 was thought to be a bad prognostic feature, especially under something called metaphase karyotyping. But then bortezomib obviated or reversed most of that risk. The same for 414. That also seems to do better with the addition of bortezomib, although that's sort of somewhat controversial, but pretty good evidence for that. So now you have things that at one time were high risk now become less high risk because of the development of a proteasome inhibitor. And the same thing for the use of lenalidomide. It helps reverse some of these high risk features based on cytogenetics. But it took a long time for people to develop the right way of doing cytogenetics. So you're supposed to pull out the plasma cells and not just do metaphase karyotyping. That's where you let the cells divide, and then they look at the chromosomes as they're dividing. There's something else that you may have heard of called FISH, and that's fluorescence in situ hybridization. That's where you take a piece of the chromosome marker, and it's lit up with something that lights up under a special light, and it fluoresces. And so that's the fluorescence in situ hybridization. And by doing this FISH, you can then determine different. So, for example, deletion 17 is much more easily seen under FISH than it is under metaphase karyotyping. Same thing with chromosome 1 abnormalities, which are thought to be high risk. So that is the beginning now, and most patients should have that type of level of cytogenetic analysis to help determine therapy, and patients who may be considered high risk may be offered clinical trials. Now, there is gene expression profiling. That's the next generation of testing, and that's been done. Again, the Arkansas group pioneered that work. And GEP70, where it's a 70-chromosome signature, or 70, sorry, gene signature that Dr. Shaughnessy and Dr. Barlogi developed, which allowed for the identification of about a 13% population, which is very high risk. Problem is, we don't know exactly what to do with those patients except offer those patients high-risk clinical trials. The Dutch also have a high-risk profile. It's called EMC92. It's a 92 gene profiling, and there's some others that have been done. There's about two or three others. So we don't know yet which is the best genetic profile to use, and we also don't know which is the what to do for them, what's the best therapy to give them. So, for example, that French-American trial that I talked about earlier, the transplant early versus transplant later, all those patients are getting genetic profiling done who enroll on that trial. And they will look in retrospect to see, okay, who did really well, who didn't do well, and which patients benefited from transplant early, which ones didn't necessarily have to get it early. And then to finish up, the one thing that we're discovering about the genetics of the myeloma cell is it's complicated. So the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation just published something recently, and there's been another one from the Dana-Farber, where they looked at the genetics of myeloma cells, and they're complicated. So what will happen is that you'll have one set of genetic abnormalities and one set of myeloma, and cells in the patient, and in the same patient you will see genetic abnormalities that are very different. And Keith Stewart at the Mayo in Arizona has shown that in, he tracked in a patient how they there were first set of genetic abnormalities at diagnosis in the patient. Patient got treated. When the disease came back, new genetic abnormalities. Treated. Came back again, another set of genetic abnormalities. It's almost kind of like whack-a-mole, where you knock down one bad clone, and then all of a sudden another one comes up. So we're doing this type of genetic testing, and that's going to help us make some good decisions about what's the best approach for patients. So I'm encouraging patients to enroll on trials such as the, it's called the determination trial, which where all patients will have their myelomas tested for genetic abnormalities and genetic sequencing.
Okay. Another question I'm not quite sure of. With the FISH testing that you were talking about,
mm-hmm.
I kind of remember, and I might be remembering the wrong way, do you have to, like, tell what chromosomal abnormalities you're looking for? Is it, like, they're not going to find everything out there? It's more of a specific type test, like you're going to say, look to see if this chromosome is mutated or this chromosome is mutated, as opposed to doing, like, a whole genome sequencing where they get everything?
Correct. That is correct. Right now, we're basing our FISH analyses on previous work, which has shown that certain chromosomes are abnormal. So, for example, the chromosome 14 has the immunoglobulin gene on it, and we know that there are a lot of translocations, 414, 1416, 1421, that are hot, because chromosomes 14 is a hot spot, and that's because it's the immunoglobulin gene, it relates to myeloma cells. So that seems to be why that occurs. Chromosome 17 has the P53, which is a tumor suppressor gene, and that not just in myeloma, but also in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and even in colon cancer, this tumor repressor gene or suppressor gene seems to be important in a variety of different cancers for keeping oncogenes in check, and because they're normal genes and they only become oncogenes when they're out of control. So you're right. We have right now to look for certain abnormalities that are already established. And thus, these new studies, and the determination trial isn't the only one. I know the British, the French, the Italians, as well as investigators in the U.S. are all looking for markers, genetic hotspots that will allow us to predict outcome, and then most importantly, knowing that there's a particular hot spot, what's the best treatment for these patients? And so, for example, I'm very excited about the monoclonal antibodies, which we think may allow us to be able to treat myeloma in a totally different way than we have in the past with both the proteasome inhibitors and the immune modulatory drugs. These antibodies attack the outside of the myeloma cell, and often in combination with lenalidomide steroids will kill off the disease, and this is a whole new approach. In addition, there are other pathways that if we can discover mutations within them, it will allow for the development of new drugs. And you probably know there's a laundry list of a variety of new pathways in the myeloma cells that we think may be important for long term. The drug for CLL, ibrutinib, may have some efficacy through the BTK pathway. The BRAF may also be important, about 10 or 15% of myeloma cells. But one thing we're discovering is that it's not going to be one size fits all. We're probably going to have different pathways targeted depending on the genetic mutations that are going to be discovered in each patient's myeloma, not just at diagnosis, but at points along the treatment continuum when the disease comes back.
Okay. Sounds really complicated to me, but I'm sure we're going to get there. And the other thing that I just really can't seem to get straight in my mind, so maybe you can help me out.
Sure.
Is what exactly is a biomarker? I am hearing a lot of things about we need to find biomarkers so we can get the right treatment to the right patient at the right dose at the right time. What are biomarkers? Does myeloma have biomarkers, or is it just in other cancers? And if we know what these biomarkers are, can we give them to drug companies and say, can you develop a drug that helps with this? Or,
sure. Biomarker.
I'm a little bit confused.
Sure. Biomarker is pretty broad. So you can use biomarkers to look at, like, when I mentioned earlier, the immune status of our patients in terms of what T cells are present or not, that is potentially a biomarker because it may predict for outcome. But that pertains to the immune status of the patient. Now, other biomarkers, are there cancer markers, biomarkers that tell us this is a good cancer or a bad one? This requires certain therapy or not. So cytogenetic testing is a biomarker. Serum free light chains are a biomarker because they tell us what if the disease is kappa or lambda. And it also tells us whether or not the patient has had a good response. And there's some thought that you may not have to do 24-hour urines for light chains because you can measure them in the serum. So biomarkers can be used to measure response, and they also may be used to predict outcome. There's a new biomarker that just was developed for myeloma called, you may know about this, the heavy light, which is a measurement of normal and abnormal immunoglobulin. In the past, we'd only be able to do that by measuring only total immunoglobulin, and then looking at the M protein, the M spike that's seen on the serum protein electrophoresis, and then sort of extrapolating to see whether or not, subtracting the M protein from the total immunoglobulin to get the amount of normal immunoglobulin that's still present. It appears that this heavy light allows us to determine how much is normal gamma globulin, normal immunoglobulin, and how much is all the myeloma protein. And that patients at presentation, it appears whose normal immunoglobulin production is suppressed by the myeloma clone, those patients may not do as well and may require different types of therapy. So there's an example of how this new test may allow us to predict outcome. And there's some preliminary data on this, but we need to get a lot more clinical data to make sure that this is truly going to be a good biomarker. So biomarkers range from what's actually present on the cancer cell, what's in the cancer cell, how the immune system is responding, to be able to allow us to predict outcome and therapy.
Okay. I think I got it a little bit better now. Thanks so much. You know what? Maybe we should go on to see who else has questions, and I don't want to
okay.
call up Dr. McCarthy all to myself.
Okay. Well, thank you. And I had Pat. He was last time, so I'm going to bring him on right now. Pat, are you online? Pat Killingsworth?
I'm here, Gary. Thanks.
Okay. Didn't want to leave you till last again, so.
No, great. I have one very specific question for Dr. McCarthy here. And Doctor, I'm glad you brought this up because I've heard before that proteasome inhibitors help mitigate the effects of 414 and the 13 deletion. And my question is, okay, so Velcade works for 2 years or 3 years or maybe 4 or 5. But what then? So I don't understand how that changes the risk profile, being somebody in the seventh year, having had 3 relapses. I mean, once a PI stops working, is it used in combination? Does that somehow change
no, you
things,
bring up or? You bring up a good point because what happens is the cells become resistant. And when I talked earlier about how the cells change their genetic profile, that's probably what's happening as to why they become resistant to proteasome inhibitors. And you may have, we can use the IMiDs as a good example. There's that protein called cereblon, which Keith Stewart came up with.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And that's a very good marker. Well, it's not a perfect marker, but it's a decent marker for resistance to thalidomide and lenalidomide and then potential response to pomalidomide. Well, it also turns out that cereblon binds some zinc finger proteins called Icarus, which are involved with B cell development. So what probably happens is for example, the proteasome, it mutates so that it's no longer binding the bortezomib, and it now is resistant. So what are we doing to try and overcome that resistance? Well, there was a Paper at Ash by Peter Voorhees, and he looked at something called an AKT inhibitor. It's another pathway. And when you combine an AKT inhibitor with bortezomib, you now make the cell sensitive. You make the patients respond. And that's very exciting. So what we're hoping is that an AKT inhibitor may allow us to treat patients who in the past had been resistant to bortezomib, and now they've become sensitive. It's called aforesitib. All these drugs have way too long names with too many syllables.
No, that's very helpful. Now, is canabinostat, is that an example of...
Panabinostat, right. HDAC inhibitor is another example of how you potentially combine with a drug and get activity. Another good example, if we go back to the IMiDs, antibodies, when combined with IMiDs, seem to work better. So, for example, you can have a patient who's resistant to lenalidomide, and then they get elotuzumab with the lenalidomide dex, and they can respond. And it appears that the lenalidomide is making the antibody work better. Now, that doesn't work for proteasome inhibitors. But we do know that when you combine, so for example, if you combine the new proteasome inhibitor, carfilzomib, and you combine it with an IMiD, such as lenalidomide, or potentially with pomalidomide and dex, you now can get responses. So it appears that you got to have combination agents, even in relapse refractory setting, that allow you to generate responses. The other drug that's now in clinical trial as well for relapse refractory is MLN-9708, exazimib. And exazimib is an oral proteasome inhibitor, which usually when combined with an IMiD and dexamethasone, shows activity in patients who have developed resistance to Velcade or bortezomib.
Well, that's very helpful. So potentially with carfilzomib and now izazimib, and there are several others coming along too, right? That I can see how maybe that now becomes moderate or standard risk. Very helpful. Thank you.
Exactly. And just to give another plug, there's another antibody called daratumumab, an anti-CD38. There's at least one or two other anti-CD38 antibodies in development. There's another proteasome inhibitor called oprazumib. There's another one called merizumib. And these are all new drugs that potentially will offer patients new options in terms of treatment.
Thank you.
Yes. Lizzie, are you online? Lizzie Smith?
Hello.
Yeah,
can you
Lizzie,
hear me?
Your question?
Hi, thank you, Dr. McCarthy. Thank you for your time today. I'm interested in when you were discussing genetic abnormalities, and so how if you get in remission and then it comes back and you might have different genetic abnormalities. Is that sometimes, and I hate to say there's anything good about myeloma, but can that sometimes maybe be a good thing? If you have a different myeloma, you might be more receptive to different kinds of treatments that maybe you weren't originally?
It depends. So sometimes the patient will respond to different treatment, but we don't know enough yet about this. What usually happens, unfortunately, though, is the disease becomes more resistant to the standard, to what the patient has seen before. And a lot of it is timing. So in other words, if a patient relapses fairly quickly after attaining or progresses after initial response, say within 6-12 months, that's very different than if a patient had a good response and then the disease, you know, maybe say had a stem cell transplant, and then 3, 4, or 5 years later the disease comes back. And sometimes it comes back and sits there. And that's great if it just sits there. But the problem is if it starts to grow and cause problems, that's when you need to treat. So we don't know enough yet to be able to say whether or not a genetic abnormality is good or bad yet.
Okay. Very good. And then I had another question going back to clinical trials. So I think from what I've been able to tell, talking to other myeloma patients, a lot of patients don't do clinical trials because they can't afford it. Either their insurance won't cover it or they can't afford the travel. Are there programs that can help get those patients into those trials if it's finances that's stopping them?
Oh, yeah, you bring up a really good point. Some insurance companies prohibit clinical trials because they will only allow the standard of care. I happen to think this is crazy, but there's all kinds of politics behind this, so I'm not sure how the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare will change this, but it does. Patients who do sign up for this are allowed to go on clinical trials. Now, I know there's pluses and minuses to Obamacare and everything else, but I think that's a really important thing, is that we need to get our companies, you know, people, the employers, educated that clinical trials are not just a black hole where money gets poured into. We learn something from this, especially large phase three trials. So I'm totally in agreement that we need to change how patients are insured so that all patients are allowed to go on clinical trials. In the meantime, there's not a lot you can do about that because a lot of these trials are prohibitively expensive because there's a lot of supportive care that needs to be paid for by the insurance company. Now, some of these trials allow for free drug. So, for example, the determination trial, the bortezomib and the lenalidomide are provided for by the companies as part of the trial, which is fantastic. But all the other supportive care needs to be paid for by the insurance company if they don't allow the clinical trial. It can't be done. And then the travel thing you bring up is a really, really important item. And right now the NCI is struggling with this because not everybody, can travel to and stay next to a cancer center or a hospital that offers a trial. Some people just can't afford to do that. So that means trying to come up with satellites that will be allowed to administer the drug and do it on trial and do all the testing and the eligibility criteria, all the things that you need to do to make sure the patient is eligible for and can stay on the trial. And that is something the NCI is wrestling with. And I think if the advocates would push for allowing a mechanism for the smaller oncology groups in that are in areas that aren't large cities where there are big cancer centers to go on trial and be monitored, oh, that'd be really important. But that's a national initiative that the NCI is going to have to lead on.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Thank
Lizzie.
You.
Yes, Priya, let's see if we can bring some callers on right now. If you're listening and you would like to ask a question of Dr. McCarthy, please hit 1 on your keypad and we'll bring you online with your question. So if you'll hit 1 and ask your question, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Gary. I just received a question via email, Dr. McCarthy. The caller wants to, I think the listener wants to ask, if a patient has no detectable disease in the bone marrow, are there MRD or other tests that can be done to detect the presence of the disease, or do they all require a bone marrow sample with malignant cells?
Yeah, the best right now, unfortunately with myeloma, the gold standard for treatment is to do a bone marrow test. There are some people who are trying to develop blood tests that will measure cells in the peripheral blood, but they're not ready for prime time because having a bone marrow is no fun. I have had one done on myself for research, and I wouldn't want to have one done every day. So right now, the gold standard still remains looking in the marrow under the microscope and doing flow cytometry to look for MRD. Some people are doing what is called PCR, a polymerase chain reaction, but that you usually have to have the diagnostic sample to make, they're called primers, to look for MRD. So right now, the gold standard still is either flow or PCR, again, using the original diagnostic sample. And we're not sure yet. We know that it predicts for better progression-free survival, but the majority of those patients still are going to have progression. So then the issue is, what kind of strategies can we develop, some type of maintenance, consolidation, and then better salvage regimens so when the disease comes back, we can treat it and get the patient to get back into remission in MRD state.
Thank you, Doctor. We have a caller online who wants to ask a question. Caller calling in from 9874359. You are on air. Please ask your question. Hello? Calling in from 9874359. Please ask your question. I think he changed his mind. Anyway, Gary, I think we have some of the panel questions remaining. Maybe we could just get into it.
Yeah, I have one for the doctor, and it's usually...
Hello?
Gary, I think the caller is on air now. Yes, please ask your question.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
So go ahead.
I'm a newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patient. I'm 50 years old.
Can you please mute your computer if you're listening to it live, because that brings an echo.
Sure.
Very good.
Thank you, Dr. McCarthy, for this inspiring program. As I said, I'm a newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patient, 50 years old, otherwise healthy. And in terms of induction therapy, doctors are talking about RVD versus Cyborg D,
right?
Followed by a transplant. There's also a trial at Weill Cornell with Kyprolis, carfilzomib, and Dex, followed by Bird maintenance. Do you have any advice for a newly diagnosed patient? Like, should I try? I mean, it seems like the consensus is around RVD for induction therapy, but just wanted to hear your views on that. I know it depends a lot on...
I think for all patients, regardless of what you do, I think some form of triple drug regimen is important for induction. And I'll get to specifics in a sec. And then the current thinking is treat to best response, collect stem cells early, and get them in the freezer. So that way you've got them. And most centers collect for more than one stem cell transplant because it potentially could be used in the future. And then the issue is transplant early versus late. So starting first with RVD versus Cyborg-D or VCD, I think RVD is used by a lot of centers. VCD is used a lot as well. That evolution trial I talked about earlier found they were about the same, but the study wasn't powered, didn't have enough patients to be able to determine which one might be better. On the CLTB 10104 study, one thing we did find is those who responded to a lenalidomide-containing induction regimen and then got lenalidomide maintenance afterwards seemed to do the best. Now, that was an unplanned subset analysis, so that's why I'm not going to go out on the limb and say you must do that. But at least it's something in your favor. So I usually recommend RVD as the first choice. And if there's any issue, maybe Cyborg-D is the second choice.
Thank you, Doctor. I think we're just about our time now. I would like to thank you so much, Dr. McCarthy, for joining us today. And I thank the panel, Pat, Jack, Cindy, and Lizzy, and Gary for their participation. It was an awesome discussion. There's a lot of information shared in this. We will be sharing the link for the show via email to all the participants. And you can always visit curepanel.carefeed.net for details of our upcoming shows. On May 27th at 6 p.m. ET, we'll be discussing osteonecrosis of jaw during myeloma with myeloma survivor and dentist Dr. John Killett. Until then, thank you and have a nice day.
Thank you so much, Dr. McCarthy.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you all, and great questions at a great time. Could do it for another hour.
We'll take you up on that.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.